Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Detroit Lions Breakdown Podcast. I'm Joe Kania. With me, as always, is Eric Schlitt from PrideOfDetroit.com, also 2020R Detroit Magazine's number two most beloved sports columnist or blogger. Eric, Thursday through Saturday was a big chunk of the Lions fan base unaffectionately calls the Lions Super Bowl,
yeah,
the NFL drafts. It ended up having seven picks over the seven rounds, which is Brad Holmes was able to pump up the pick group by a couple of picks. We only had six going in.
Yeah, I had six going in, came out with seven, and a whole bunch of undrafted guys. So end up with total of 20 rookies that'll be on the roster. So not bad.
And we're going to have a 90-man roster going into camp, and we still don't have all 90 spots full at this moment.
Yeah, we're at 85. So there's still five spots open for maybe another undrafted free agent, maybe a veteran. There's some
that gets cut.
Yeah. Or maybe even that's still out there, because there's a couple of them that are still could still contribute. So especially like at safety, right? So we'll take a look at like what the roster looks like, and we'll talk about these picks, and we'll try and get everybody up to date on the new additions.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll get to those 13 undrafted free agents in just a few minutes. We'll start with the regular draft picks. First round, the headliner pick seven, Penei Sewell from Oregon, offensive tackle. You generously list him at 6'5", 331 pounds.
Yeah. Look, you get your guy, right? When's the last time that you had a guy
from the beginning?
Right.
I never get my guy.
I'm agreeing. I can't remember the last time you had a guy that you were like, this is him, that ended up coming to fruition. So maybe you're going to like this new regime.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe we'll see. Hopefully, I have the automatic concern. I think a lot of teams have this concern too. There's so many. He's one of the guys who opted out of the 2020 season, but to really no fault of his own, through everything that was going on at like the Pac-12 starting so late, he just decided, to cut the season short. Yeah. And of course, we here in Detroit have the concern because of what happened with Mike Williams during the Matt Millen era. But that was under kind of a different circumstance. He was a freshman at USC, and they were challenging the whole, you need to be 3 years out of high school. And I don't want to say this because I can't remember for certain, but wasn't there also an academic component with Williams that maybe he couldn't go back to USC? I knew that was true for Claret, but maybe that wasn't true by Mike Williams.
No, with Williams, if I recall correctly, he just tried to buck the system when Claret.
I think he was just joining up with Claret. Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think there was no not being able to get back into school type of thing. Right. And, that failed miserably for the Lions. And so there's a couple of these guys, right, that the Lions drafted this year. And we'll see how that goes. But the one thing I always go back to as far as with Sewell is if there's a huge amount of scouts across the business seem to agree on one of these offensive tackles, they're usually right. Like if there's a big consensus that this guy's a top five type player, he's going to be a great offensive tackle, they're usually right. Every now and again, the Robert Gallery, they weren't exactly right on, but guys like Pace and Ogden, Joe Thomas, they've been right about all those guys. So hopefully he's another one in that list.
Yeah. You're going to hear a lot of, you maybe have even heard a lot of talk about how if he was in last year's class, he wouldn't have been the top guy. And look, I like athletic tackles, right? And last year, Tristan Wirfs was my number one. And I know, we had Jedrick Wills in there and Robinson, and Robinson was first, right? There's, people are going to grade these guys all differently, right? Some of them are going to say, hey, I had this guy first or this guy first, and Sewell would have been third or I don't know, whatever, right? Everybody has these differing opinions. Here's the thing. I like athletic tackles. I liked Wirfs a ton, and Sewell was right up there with him for me. And if he was in last year's class, he probably would have been two, because I really, really liked Wirfs last year. But I don't know, maybe he would have been one. It's hard to speculate and go back and say, hey, this is what I think would have happened. The bottom line is the dude is a beast, right? He is a massive guy with nimble feet, and he did opt out last season. And the reason he couldn't go back was because he decided to declare for the draft when the Pac-12 announced that they weren't having the season. He said, all right, I'm going pro anyways. And he signed an agent. He started training. And then when they decided to go back on, he was like, he was already in full training mode. He wasn't no longer in, I'm going to try and be in a game player mode. I think the hiring of the agent complicated matters as well. So he was gone. And a lot of that was because the season was canceled. So regardless, this is a guy who put up enough tape in his 2 years at Oregon that warrants a top 10 pick, right? This was a guy who most people thought was a top 5 pick. And in all honesty, if there weren't three quarterbacks taken at the top, he would have probably been in the top 5, you know, depending because of how the order of things might have worked out. So he's a extraordinary talent. There's a lot of people that really sing high praises about him. The Lions believe that he is a foundational piece that they want to build around, right? And they have Taylor Decker on the left side, and so Sewell's going to play the right. And they believe that having these bookend tackles is going to help solidify their offense and take it to the next level. Now, the next big criticism about him is that people say, oh, he played left tackle at Oregon. How is he going to be able to translate to right tackle? Because not every player can switch between the right and the left side because you're doing things in reverse. Here's the thing. He was a right tackle in high school. So he had 4 years of experience at right tackle and then 2 years of experience at left tackle. He's going to be fine back at right tackle again.
Yeah,
right?
But at the same, well, it's the same to high school, playing 4 years of, you know, right tackle. There's a number of our listeners that, you know, have four years of experience at right tackle in high school. So, like, I don't know if that means as much. I'd sat on that. He stepped in as a freshman, as a true freshman, I believe, at Oregon, as like a 17-year-old and won the left tackle job. So I would use that more of like, well, he was able to step in and play the most important spot, well, arguably the most important spot on the line. You know, he advanced past all of it, so like,
right,
you would stand to think he could play right tackle
too. Well, I guess my point is that from a technical standpoint, his body is already familiar with playing on that side, right? His body is technically familiar on both sides of the line. He's comfortable with either foot forward. He's comfortable leaning on either hand. He doesn't have limitations. There are certain players that are going to struggle with this. Absolutely. And then there are other players who can do it flawlessly because they're just talented. And Sewell is one of these guys that will have no issue switching to the right side. There's not going to be a lag. At his pro days and during his trainings, he was training specifically at right tackle as well as left tackle to show that he could be a right tackle in the league. Anthony Lynn, the Lions offensive coordinator, was at the pro day. He watched him play at right tackle. And he got a good, and he, you know, was sold on him. So there's, and then, okay. So those are the two main criticisms that you hear about Sewell. Now the positives. You said one of the big ones right off the bat. He was 17 years old and started in the Pac-12 at left tackle. And he didn't just start, he dominated, right? He just ragdolled people for 2 years before this past season came about. And so he's going to be 20 years old when he enters the NFL. He's going to start, and there's no reason really to think that he's not going to continue that success. So this is a kid who has a extraordinary ceiling. He's going to be 25 when he's up for his second contract. Like, that's lunacy. You could get 2 5-year contracts out of him, and he still won't even have hit the 30-year-old mark. That's nuts. You can get this guy, you can have him as a staple of your team for a decade, and he'll still be peaking when you're getting into his, you know, third contract. That's phenomenal. That's That's great value. That's exciting to have. And when you watch him play, he is technically sound. He is a guy who attacks with the idea that he wants to move you. Like he doesn't want to just get in your way. He wants to relocate you. And there are lots of times when he would get, you know, if he's either taking the guy in front of him or if he's pulling with his athleticism, getting out to the second level, and then he's just like smashing, steamrolling through guys. He is very effective at understanding leverage. He bends at the knees, which not a lot of offensive tackles do. That's why he's rated so high. Bends at the knees, keeps his balance, and his slide and his ability to move during the play are just lights out. He has very good awareness. If you look at some of his tape, you can see he'll be blocking one player and he'll see another player struggling and he'll hit that other player while he's still guarding the one. Like so many plays, he gets out and he blocks one guy into another and he ends up taking two guys out of play. I mean, it was like, I've seen it 15, 20 times where he's blocked two guys, maybe intentionally or not intentionally, but he's just clearing people out. It's because he has this, I want to destroy you type attitude. And and to take it a step further, now you start talking about his mentality on the field is aggressive. His mentality off the field is appreciative and wanting to succeed for his family. And he's viewing the Lions as his family and he's very passionate. And like, there's just so much to like about him as a player, so much to like about him as a person. I'm very excited. This was the guy that we both said we liked and both that we said would be the ideal pick to fall to us on our last podcast. And so I'm just excited. I'm excited to see him. You know, from a draft strategy, some people, some of the complaints were that the Lions didn't get a playmaker, right?
That seems to be that's the big one.
Here's the thing.
But I don't know. I'll give you my opinion on that one.
Yes.
With valid, they're going to need playmakers, but at the same time, they're not shooting for the Super Bowl next year. I mean, they're not going to say that, but like, this team's not winning anything. What does it matter if they have playmakers? Look what happened the last time you drafted a playmaker at number two overall. He hung around for 10 years and then retired with, you know, not with nothing, but with nothing for his, as far as playoff win legacy goes for it. So what does it matter if they would have taken a playmaker? You know, like they can take playmakers next year. They didn't have to do it right now. I don't know what the big fuss about that was.
The thing with me is that if you watch him play, he's a playmaker. Like he may not be the guy that's catching the pass. He may not be the guy that's scoring the touchdown, but he's the guy that's giving the quarterback time to make that pass. He's the guy that's clearing the lane for that running back to get behind to score the touchdown. Like he is involved in every play. And he's the guy more often than not, that is the catalyst for the success of the skill player. So if you don't think he's a playmaker, I don't know what to tell you, because this dude, he makes plays multiple times a game that stand out and make you go, wow, that's rare stuff, right? So I get that people were interested in a receiver or a quarterback. I understand that desire, but the thing is this is a terrific player that you're getting at value, and he's going to be a staple, and I have zero issue with it. It was the best case scenario for me. He was the number two non-quarterback on my board, and I didn't think they were going quarterback, right? And in all honesty, on Detroit's board, I believe he was number one. So I think the Lions got exactly what they want. What's interesting is that Brad Holmes came out and said that once he knew Lance was going three to San Fran, he knew he wasn't going to take a quarterback at seven. I guess Lance was the last quarterback he was willing to take in the top seven. And so when Lance went, he called up and tried to trade with Cincinnati, and Cincinnati wouldn't trade with them. Then he tried to trade with Miami, and Miami wouldn't trade with them. So he tried to go up to get Sewell twice, and it just didn't pan out. And then Sewell, luckily enough for them, fell into their lap. So I think they were very fortunate what they want. I'm excited to hear Brad Holmes was aggressive in trying to get his guy. We're going to talk about his aggression at a couple more spots here as well. But I was very happy at the end of day one.
What about the aggression of Brad Holmes with Rod Wood after the pick was made? Man, the timeline of that might be wrong. That was like right after he called him. I don't know.
He called him and then passed the phone to Dan Campbell and then passed the phone to Sheila. And then Campbell passed the phone to Sheila. And Holmes, he passes the phone over. He goes back to his desk and he smacks the desk and yells like a hoorah thing. The pen on the desk hits the ceiling because he hit the desk so hard. And then he said he didn't even realize it was Rod Wood at first. He just was, I'm going to hug the first person I see. And it had just happened to be, 170-year-old Rod Wood, who he almost broke in half.
Oh, easy. You got to work with Rod. You might be in the same room with him. So that's what you say about him.
Then he grabs Spielman, and Spielman is trying to hold his spot, and he pulls Spielman off of it. Then he comes back and he grabs Dorsey, and Dorsey tries to give him a little side hug, and he almost throws Dorsey to the ground. I mean, look, he was overly pumped, but that's fine. This is a guy who's been working towards this spot for almost two decades. You know what I mean? And for him to get there and then make his first, I'm sure he had massive amounts of emotions running through him. And he was very excited. He got the guy he wanted. And we talked so much about that. He had to nail this first pick. He had to get the right guy to help build his legacy as a GM. And he wanted Sewell so bad. He was willing to try and get up and get him to cement that foundation. And so, I mean, look, I enjoy the excitement. It's fun. It's nice to see raw emotion like that. And that's really what it was.
All right. We can't go on too much more about Sewell. There's one other part though, is that he's a Lions fan. Claims to have been raised a Lions fan, or he grew up as a Lions fan, which kind of odd, you know, but.
Well, it was Madden. It was because of Madden. He liked Javid Best and Calvin. He liked that combo, and he would use them to beat his brothers, and that made him a Lions fan. And you know what? It's great. Now he gets to be one in real life.
Even better.
Yeah.
But that's the team he wanted to be drafted by. All right, let's move on. We got to move on here. Everybody's heard a lot about Sewell. Round two, pick 41. Levi Onwuzurike, which I was close. I was going on Onwuzurike.
Yeah.
Last week, but Onwuzurike, I was still wrong. Mm-hmm. Defensive tackle from the University of Washington, 6'3", 290. From my snapshot here, Eric, does he play the Brockers position or does he play the Flowers position?
I think he plays the Flowers position.
So my concern as Lions fan is I wanted them to walk away with starters, right? And here we're already in round two and we're making a pick. Although I don't mind them going after defensive linemen. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy who's probably not going to start this coming fall.
Yeah, so if we look at Flowers' history, Flowers typically plays around 60 to 65% of snaps. So there's about 35-40 snaps left over, percent of snaps left over. And then Brockers, you're going to see a similar type thing. You're going to see him leaving snaps on the field as well. So both of those spots are not players that play 100% of the time. They play roughly 60 to 65. When they're not on the field, you need competent players to back them up. And this is where he comes in. Now, he may not be a technical starter, okay? But it would not surprise me at all to see Brockers at 60%, Flowers at 60%, Onwuzurike at 60%, right? And then like a couple other guys filling in those last 20%, you know, with whether it's Deshaun Hand or, you know, Jayshon Cornell or whoever else steps up. I still think Onyeka is going to get a close to starter level snaps, even though he technically won't be a starter because they're going to want to rotate the line. And I'll tell you what, if when you get into next year and you start looking at Flowers' contract and the fact that he isn't really made for this system, he's made for a different system. It's very possible. Yeah, I'm just saying it's very possible that this is a precursor to Flowers maybe wanting to exit. Now, I'm not saying he does. I don't have any insider. I'm just saying he was very much a Matt Patricia guy. He was brought in for that system. He's going to be playing a different position than what he normally has played in the past. There's going to be an adjustment. You're going to be paying him a lot of money. And if he's not happy and you're paying him a lot of money, it's possible that this is not a marriage that is long. But I still think Flowers is a very important person on this roster. I think he can contribute in a lot of very important ways. And I think Onyeka is just a complement to that. I think he can play the Flowers role. I think he can play the blockers role. He's versatile like that. Now, he played nose at Washington, and last time when we previewed him a couple of podcasts ago, we talked about the fact that Washington uses their one of their best athletes at the nose in order to try and get a mismatch. In the NFL, he's going to be outside of the nose. He's going to be at that 3-5 or that 4-eye, and he's going to be asked to be more of a penetrator and maybe a lateral run stuffer than a guy that we want to plant at the nose and try and occupy, right? So he's a very talented player. He is very colorful, I think, if you saw the interview or anything.
He's a kneecap about player. That,
right? He has very much the mentality that the Lions are looking for. He wants to embarrass people, and he wants to mess up the offensive line, and he wants to mess up the offensive plans. And his first step, he can do that. But it's not just his first step. He has really powerful hands, right? Both Sewell and Onyeka and the next guy we're going to talk about all have really powerful. It's a common theme. They like guys that have good hand usage and can really like jar their opponent when they hit them. And he can do that. So you got a first step athlete who can knock people off their blocks with his punch. And he's a penetrator. Look, we've complained for so long that we haven't seen a penetrating offensive lineman since Ndamukong Suh. This is a penetrating defensive lineman. I meant defense.
You said offense. Yeah, I meant defense.
Correct. This is a penetrating defensive lineman. This is something that the fans have been clamoring for a very long time. And this guy provides it. Now, he was a very good run stuffer in college. He has very good lateral agility, right? He's a lot of raw talent that's still being molded. There's going to be aspects of his game that he has to learn because he played at the nose and he's going to be playing at a different spot here. So like the angles are going to be different, right? And it may not seem like that big of a deal to move from the one to the three but the angles are different. How you take that first step and how, which shoulder you attack. There's going to be a lot of nuances that he has to figure out. So there's going to be a bit of a learning curve. And so it's probably good that he's not going to be a starter this year, in all honesty, because he's got to figure some things out. But there's a lot of raw talent there that make him very appealing. Now, look, we talked a lot about how this defensive tackle class was not as strong as some of the ones in the past, but we also mentioned that if you hit the right guys at the right spots, you can still get value. Well, this was a value pick. He was supposed to go around here or maybe a little bit earlier. And when you talk again, when you listen to Brad Holmes hinted at the fact that when the first round was coming to a close, he mentioned that he was calling back into the teams at the end of the first round and talking about eliciting a trade. And then we find out the next day that I believe, reading the tea leaves on some of the things that Holmes said, I believe it was Anzorike that he was targeting. I think Holmes looked at him and said, this is a guy that I think is a first round pick that I'm trying to get at the end of the first round. Now, here's that's great. Again, that matches with the aggression that I talked about with Sewell. But here's where Holmes, I think, really impressed me, is that while he was making phone calls and while he was evaluating if he could move up, at the same time, he had people in his ear in the room saying, hold on, let's just wait things out. Let's be patient. Let's see what happens. I know this is your guy. This is the guy you want, but let's just stay calm and let's see how it plays. They looked at who was in between. They debated on who might take a defensive tackle, and they waited, and that waiting paid off. So he's aggressive, but he's not reckless, right? He listened to his advisors that he had in the room, and he waited, and then boom, there we go. Anzorike falls to him, and he doesn't hesitate, and they take him, and they're ecstatic again. So two nice foundational pieces to rebuild the line, and now they're off and cooking.
All right. Okay, wait. One last question on Anzorike. He's played nose tackle at Washington.
Yeah.
By the end of the season, could you see him playing nose tackle in, like, third and long situations? Or they might want to go with more pass rushers out on the field.
So here,
that's a possibility.
I don't, but let me explain why. It's because when they get into those third and long situations, they don't use a nose tackle. Okay. The nose tackle comes off the field in favor of a more athletic player, whether that's a linebacker or a defensive back. So it's not like in Patricia's scheme, he left the nose in the NASCAR and he put Deshaun Hand like at the nose to try and get that athlete. They just throw the nose out and they just add more bodies at the 5 yard line, whether it's, you know, a different style of athlete. So in those third and long situations, there's no nose spot. So that's why I don't think he would play it.
All right. Round three, pick 72, Aleem McNeil. Nose tackle, North Carolina State, 6'2", 317, fine. Another big guy. I like the big guys. And does he now supplant John Pennacini as the starting nose tackle?
I believe so. On my list, he is the starting nose because Pennacini is a good player, but McNeil has the potential to be much, much better. In this scheme, you need a nose that can one gap and two gap. Pennacini is a very good two gapper who was a developing one gapper. It's almost the flip with McNeil. He is an extraordinarily good penetrator who can also hold his own. Like he could absorb double teams and triple teams at times. Like he has a pretty good solid anchor where he can just sit and occupy. But at the same time, his best trait is his ability to get to the ball. And so now you've added two defensive linemen who are both penetrators. And so you want to talk about revamping that offensive line quick. Well, you did this because even if you're rotating six players through those three spots, you brought in Brockers. Now you brought in these two guys. You've replaced half of the guys that are there to try and improve the pass rush. And now you're in and moving flowers inside should generate more pass rush as well. So you're going to see a very different defensive line this year than what we are used to seeing. So McNeil, I believe is going to be the starter. He's an excellent, look, talk about an athlete, right? He played outfield on his baseball team. He played running back and linebacker when he was in high school. Yeah, and he went to North Carolina State as a linebacker, and then he added more weight and got bigger and stronger, and then took over that nose spot pretty quickly, and he's continued to gain mass and frame. But like, he's got a pick six, you know what I mean? Like like he has that style.
A nice video,
right? And so he has that athleticism. Like he's a guy who isn't your typical nose tackle because he can do both things. And I mean, look, we spent a lot of time talking about the fact that a nose that can do both things is is very important in this scheme, and he does it. Like, he was one of my favorite picks. I mean, Sewell was my favorite pick because I, you know, I'm gaga over his potential. But after Sewell, McNeil might have been my favorite pick, my favorite second, next favorite pick, because he has such just raw potential and just raw upside. And he can come in and he might play 40, 50 snaps as a starter, but then that's, that might be it. And that's fine. Okay. You're going to, that's great value for the third round. And he's not a typical nose tackle, right? He's a guy who, you know, a typical nose tackle is going to get drafted in the fifth, sixth round, like Pennacini did. Not this guy. This guy is more. The fact that he got drafted in the third tells you he is more. And if you watched the video on the Philadelphia, did you see the video on the Philadelphia Eagles from their war room? I don't know if you caught that.
No, I didn't catch that.
All right. So the Philadelphia Eagles had pick 70 and they decided to trade back to pick 73 and they acquired like a fifth rounder. And I guess they looked at their board, if you, and their GM talked about this later because the video was pretty horrible. But the GM told us later that they were at 70. They had a guy that they wanted that they thought they could get at 73, and they traded back, and then that guy was taken in between 70 and 73, okay? And again, then the guy they took was a defensive tackle, Milton Williams. So it sure seems like the guy that they wanted was McNeil. And what's interesting and what's funny about this video is that they took McNeil and ESPN cut to their war room, and it looked like the most deflated war room in the that I've ever seen. The GM was running around like, yay. And everyone else was like, ugh. They gave him limp wrist fist bumps. And the one dude fist bumped and then just shook his head. They looked so lethargic and disappointed. Like, I believe McNeil was the guy they wanted. And when Detroit, they didn't expect Detroit to take him because they had just took Onwuzurike. And when the McNeil wasn't there at 73, they were just deflated. They said, hey, you know, you fall in love with guys all the time. And then when they, you think you're going to get them and then you don't. And then, you know, there was a lot of disappointed people in the room. So, I mean, first of all, poor Milton Williams, right? Right. Just, this is the Eagles' reaction to picking you, right? Poor guy. But this is an example of, like, you know, just drafting for value. People didn't think the Lions were going to go defensive line again, but Holmes said, I'm going to follow my board. This is a guy we like. This is a guy that fits our value platform. And so we're going to take him. And they did. Look, he was a guy who a lot of people had second round grades on. And again, for a nose tackle to have that high, a day two grade, it tells you how special of a player that he has the potential to be. Onwuzurike was the number two defensive tackle on my list. McNeil was number four. And I had Milton ahead because I liked his athleticism, but they were right next to each other on my board. So they both went around where I thought they should go. But, like, this is about getting value at the spot. And this is now the third pick in a row where Holmes ends up getting value.
All right. So moving on to the later in the third round, pick 101. Efatu Melifonwu, cornerback from Syracuse, 6'2.5", 205. I think we had some concerns about this guy for his speed, I think, when we were talking about him during our one of our podcasts leading up to the draft.
Well, he had 4.48 speed, so that's fine speed.
I think
with
we
me.
Were talking about Elijah Molden. Never mind.
Yep, we were talking. Yeah, Elijah Molden had some speed issues. Yeah. Melifonwu, I think the big concern with me was his brother was a lot like him, and his brother Obi busted after going in the second round, right? And so he has a lot of physical traits similar to his brother. The difference is that he's a better player than his brother was. His brother got drafted on traits because, you know, when his brother came into the league 5 years ago, we weren't used to seeing guys that could do the things that he did athletically, right? But just to give you an example, Efatu had a 4.48 40, but his vertical was 41.5, right? Which was I think second in the class, and then
But it looks like behind Robert Rochell.
Yeah, and then his broad jump was 11.2, I believe. That's nutso. If you hit 10, that like 10's a great marker for these. 11 is rare air. I think there was maybe two or three, four maybe guys that hit the 11 mark this year. But he's got – so that points to his explosion, right? When you look at his RAS score, his collective athleticism score, it was a 9.7 out of 10, right? Like he was near the top of the class when it comes to athleticism. And what's interesting about him is that, he is still developing, which is why he ends up going in the third round. But this is another player that a lot of people had ranked in the second round. Lance Zierlein, Dane Brugler, the Draft Network all had second round grades on him. And I had him as an early third rounder. Lions get him at the end of the third round, right? He's a talented player who's tall and supremely athletic, but it's going to take him a little bit of time. And if you want him to be a guy who can challenge to start, then this is a good spot to get him. If you remember, when we were talking about corners two podcasts ago, we talked about the fact that you need three outside corners in order to survive in the NFL. And right now the Lions have Jeff Kuda, Amani Oruwariye, and they signed Quentin Dunbar. So you wouldn't think they would need another outside corner, but Dunbar's
on the Lions do. We're going to see a lot of, even with these four guys, Melifonwu, Dunbar, Oruwariye, and Okuda, we're going to see a lot of Mike Ford.
Right.
A lot of Mike Ford during the year.
Well, Dunbar's on a 1-year contract. So with it taking time for rookies at corner to acclimate to the NFL, if you give him a year and then he replaces Dunbar as cornerback three, well, now you've done your job in preparing him and not just throwing him into the fire. So again, it's not a starter, but it's a guy who can play a pivotal role next year. He'll play a pivotal role this year. Like you just said, he's going to see the field. There's a lot of things about him that can make him a player that's different than the other corners that they have. For example, he can be a matchup guy on like big slot receivers, right? I think Jeff Okuda can do this same type of thing, where if you have a big slot that a lot of the outside corners would typically struggle against, the smaller nickels would typically struggle against. Melifonwu and Okuda are both guys that I think can match up well in the slot against bigger slot receivers. So there's that talent. Holmes talked about the fact that what sold him on him was that while he is clearly a guy who you look at and say he's a press man guy, which he can, it was his ability to play off coverage that impressed him. His ability to sit into a zone in an off coverage and the athleticism to break on plays and be successful is something that you don't often see in a player at his size, but his athleticism and his instincts allow him to do that. And so if things click for him and they don't click for, like, let's say Oruwariye, well, Melifonwu is a guy who has a ceiling where he could be a starter down the road. He doesn't necessarily just have to be cornerback three. He can be cornerback two or one, right? So this is an upside pick. This is a guy that you're saying, hey, this is a vital and important position. You can never have enough cornerbacks and we need them. The value is there. This guy has long-term potential. Maybe he can help us out this year. And again, value, value, value. Every one of these picks is value-based. So, again, from a value standpoint, you have to like that. They basically took the script of needs and just chucked the needs out the window and just said, we're going to take the best player available and pretend like, our roster's empty. We'll just take the next best guy. And, we'll see where we are when all the dust settles. And so right now, that's what they're doing. They're adding the best player on their board. And it's a good strategy for year one of a rebuild. Excuse me.
All right, moving on to the fourth round, pick 112. Amon-Ra St. Brown, wide receiver, USC, 6 feet, 197. His brother, Equiminius, plays for the Green Bay Packers. I saw the Real Sports on this family a long time ago. Very interesting family it comes from.
Yeah, Egyptian family, right? Parents are from Egypt, right? Highly intelligent. He took, I believe he took the SAT in three different languages, if I'm not mistaken. He's just a highly intelligent player. Now, that intelligence pays off for him on the football field in a lot of ways, and it helps him overcome some of the, I don't want to say deficiencies, but some of the places where he's average as far as the NFL athleticism is concerned. For example, I think he's going to be a slot. I think he's not just going to be a slot. I think he's going to start in the slot for them, right? So we came into this draft saying we would like them to get three clear starters. This is your third clear starter right now. While Melifonu and Onwuzurike are probably going to be like heavily in the rotation, St. Brown should be a starter, right? I think he's just such a polished player. And this is where the intelligence comes in. He's extraordinarily polished as a route receiver. And he understands how to work within his routes, whether it's man coverage, whether it's zone. He knows how to throttle down inside zones. He knows how to maintain his throttle when going after the ball. He's very good at keeping his hands down until the ball arrives so that it doesn't show that the ball's coming his way and alert the defender. He has solid hands. He's not a guy who's necessarily going to be like – this quick twitch slot guy that you're used to seeing. But if you utilize him with the slot, when he's in the slot, if he lines up like off the line of scrimmage, he's going to get a lot. He's going to get much cleaner breaks. If you put him on the line of scrimmage, he can get out muscled a little bit, but he has quite a few moves that allow him to get off those blocks and get into his route. But it just makes it even easier when you allow him to take that one step back off the line. He gets off clean and smooth, and then he adds in those separators, and he finds ways to get open. He's very clean. I mean, he's a very clean prospect. All of the technical stuff that he does right is going to make him start on day one. And when you look at how some of the comparisons for him, it's a lot like Robert Woods, who was a guy that the Rams identified and took, who was an average player, and they turned him into a better player because they understood what he did well. This is the same type of thing with St. Brown. He does so many things well that if you put him in the right situations, he can really excel. Some of the best routes that he runs are some of the best routes that you – are just simple plays, like just whether it's an out or slants, like these are ways for him to get open quickly. And it's things that Jared Goff relies on, right? So he's a guy that can be like a check down guy. He's a guy who can be a feature. Now, he's not going to be this elite yak guy, like a Golden Tate necessarily, right? But there's enough there with what he does within his routes that he's able to gain yards. He's comfortable in traffic. So he's comfortable going over the middle. He can make contested catches. Like there's so many, he is the most professional of the wide receivers in that went in the top like 100 picks or 112 picks, right? He is a professionally based receiver who's going to step on the field with that professional mindset and intelligence, and he should be a guy who starts on day one.
Now, just a slight correction: that I do not think the family has like Egyptian roots.
Oh,
his dad is John Brown, born and raised California. He was a three-time Mr. World. His mom's from Germany, and I know if I remember the segment correctly from Real Sports, like part, he married his kid's mom because like in part because he knew like her genes were going to give like his kids NFL stock type of thing,
right? And I do remember that with Equiminius when he came out.
And he has of course the three kids have different last name than the parents because he wanted them to stand out. That's why it's Saint Brown and not just Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, but you were right about, I know the education part that he took, you said he took the SAT in three lane because there was like a big emphasis on education. But like most of the upbringing of the kids was very similar to Todd Marinovich's father, if you know that story. Like these kids were raised to play in the NFL one.
Right.
Yeah, that, so that's what I was remembering when it comes to the St. Browns. But hey, he's 2 for 3. The third one's at Stanford, so it's working so far.
I tell you what's interesting is that his dad is a bodybuilder, right? Mr. World, right? And then Swift's dad, also bodybuilder, right? He owns his own gym. Mm-hmm. Very interesting that these young skill players are coming from these bodybuilding families. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they do. I'm sure when the kids get into sports, their dad knows what they need to do, you know, to get stronger and to get faster. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that has a big component of it. And whether Holmes and the crew there are looking for those, that type of background, maybe they are, maybe they're, maybe it's just a coincidence.
I think he's the first piece in the wide receiver overhaul. Now you've got all these other receivers on 1 year deals. You got four other receivers on 1 year deals. You have Quintez Cephas, who's going to find a role somewhere, I believe. But to turn this receiver room over, I think we're going to see the more traditional outside receivers added in the next, over the next couple of years. I don't think like he's the goal for him is to be the number one, right? I don't think that that's ever going to be in his range, right? But he's going to be a steady, reliable professional. And that's a big important thing to have for your quarterback. You need to have that guy that you can rely on.
All right. Next pick was the very next pick in the draft, round 4, pick 113. Derek Barnes, linebacker from Purdue, 6'1", 238 pounds. Now this is that we traded into this pick.
Yeah. Right. And he in it by a lot, right. They had to go, they had to trade up to get this pick. Now, I don't know why I'm blanking on the pick number that they had. I think it was like 157 or something like that, right? No, it can't be that because it's 257. All right, something. They had to move up like 60
153.
Spots. 153, thank you. So they moved up 40 spots, right? That's aggressive. Again, I hate to keep harping on this, but this is another aggressive move to move up 40 spots to the pick right behind your pick to get your guy means that this is a guy that you like enough that you're willing to not just give up a pick now, but you're willing to give up a pick in next year's draft as well. Cause they had to give up a fourth rounder next year. And then they got a seventh rounder in return as well. So they got their fourth round from they got from the Browns and the seventh rounder from the Browns. And then they gave up a fourth rounder next year. So this is a guy that you have to say he's worth not just a fourth round this year, but a fourth round next year, which means they probably had a third round grade on him again, right? And so Barnes is a very interesting linebacker. And you'll talk to some people that are like super high on him. And there was some reports that The Athletic put out today that was saying things like he's better than Jared Davis was like at any point in Jared Davis's career. Right. So he was a off the ball outside linebacker. I'm sorry, not off the ball. He was a outside linebacker who was essentially used as like a pass rusher at Purdue. Now, right. He was a guy who was a little bit undersized for the edge because he's only 6 foot, 240 pounds, but he understood leverage. He had very good first step. He understood how to use angles. And so he was productive as a outside edge. But as a senior, they decided to move him off the ball. And they moved him to like an inside linebacker in their 3-4 system. And it, at that inside the ball spot, that's essentially the exact same role that he's probably going to play here with the Lions, which is essentially the Alex Anzalone role, right? Again, Anzalone's on a 1-year deal. This is a situation where Barnes needs a little bit more seasoning, won't take long, and then he's a guy who could end up starting next year, taking snaps away from Anzalone this year. It really depends on how he progresses, because like I said, he only got moved off the ball a year ago, but he was highly successful when he was off the ball. He's a great blitzer. So he's got all that edge mentality, but when you apply it to the off the ball, he hits those A and B gaps really quickly. He knows how to get home because he spent all that time on the edge. And he's a guy who's comfortable dropping into a zone, but he's really inexperienced when it comes to man coverage. And this is where I think there's going to be the biggest learning curve for him. Purdue never asked him to man up on guys. They just didn't. It wasn't part of their scheme. And so he doesn't have that skill set in his arsenal, but he looks good in zone. He looks good when he's blitzing. He looks good against the run, but he still has things to develop. So I don't think he's a guy who's going to come in and start, but I think he's a guy who's going to be part of the rotation. You know, they like to rotate those off the ball guys. And this is a guy who's probably going to be the third linebacker in that two-man linebacker rotation. So he's going to get snaps. He's going to see the field. He needs to develop, but long-term he has that potential to start as another guy who could maybe start next year. So, I mean, and depending on what happens with the rest of the roster, we've said that about the first six guys already. These are guys that could be starting a year from now. So we got three guys that are starting, three guys that could be starting in a year. That's not a bad first six picks. And, Barnes, he's a very interesting guy. There's things about his game that I'm like, man, he's just not ready. And then there's other parts of his game that are like, holy cow, you don't see off the ball linebackers, rush like that. Jamie Collins can do that. Jamie Collins was an edge rusher for a long time, and he can still bring it when he needs to. If he could develop into a Jamie Collins, my goodness, that would be fantastic, right? But you got to see how it goes. You got to be careful not to crown him too early, but there's enough talent there that was, that warranted them driving up into the draft to go get him. So, did you get a chance to watch much Purdue with him? No. I don't know if he stood out. Yeah.
No, he did not stand out to me. I mean, I did watch some Purdue games, but he never stood out to me.
So, there's a lot to like about him. He's a guy who I think I was a little lower on because he was more developmental, but I started looking at him a lot harder, a lot closer, and I get it, man. I get the intrigue. I don't know if I would have traded up, but obviously they thought they needed to get him. So here's the first pick that maybe didn't match my value board, right? But mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that it's not a good pick, and they seem to like him a ton. I'm liking him more the more I'm digging into him. I had watched some of his stuff, but it's hard when you're looking at this guy and you're watching a game from 2019 when he's edge rushing, and you're trying to figure out how's this going to project, and then you catch a 2020 and you're like, all right, I can see it a little bit more, but maybe you didn't watch the right game. And so I was a little lower on him on my board, but the more I'm learning, the more I like, I think there's good potential there.
All right. And the last pick, which is also was a surprise pick, a pick they traded into round 7, 257, running back Jamar Jefferson from Oregon State, 5'10", 206. Now this one is your least favorite pick of the draft.
Yeah, I didn't like him as much, but it's only because I like the other guys quite a bit, I had a fifth round grade on him, so I get it. He has a ceiling of becoming Jordan Howard, so there's potential. But as we talked about last podcast, running back was one of the spots where if they would have ignored it, that would have been fine too. Essentially, with the third to last pick in the draft, all you're doing is guaranteeing that you're getting one of your undrafted guys, right? Because at that point, you're just saying, this is a guy I probably look at as a undrafted Or maybe, you know, Holmes said he had a higher grade on him. And I believe that. He could have had a fifth round grade, like a lot of people gave him. But you're not looking to draft in the seventh round. You're not looking to draft a guy that's going to be like a contributor. You're looking to draft, you're taking a flyer and pick 257 is you're just guaranteeing, instead of trying to talk him into signing with you, you're just making sure. So when they were looking at their undrafted guys, they said, which is the top undrafted guy target that we have? And that's the one they took. And that's Jefferson. Now, Jefferson's going to be RB4. I don't think there's any question about that. He's not going to supersede any of the other guys. And there's enough chip on his shoulder that, you know, he could be a guy that ends up producing. Now, he left early as a junior because he had what he believed he was getting. The advice he was getting was, you're going to go into third or fourth round. And so that's what he was expecting, right? Mm-hmm. And then he ends up dropping to the seventh. And so now he was pretty angry. When we talked to him after the draft, I'm not sure I've seen a chip on someone's shoulder any bigger than that. And that can be a good thing. Now, athletically, nothing really stands out about him. I mean, nothing, right? He's average pretty much everywhere, if not even below average at a couple of spots. But this could be one of the best examples of a player who's better on tape than he is athletically. And this speaks to that whole adage that Holmes has of, I'm drafting what I see on tape, not, you know, the athletic scores that get produced at his pro day. Because when you look at him on tape, he gets north-south very quickly. He has really good vision. And so if you run a zone scheme, which is really what we're expecting, he's a guy that knows where the cutback lane is. He's a guy who knows where the outside zone lane is. He knows where the inside zone lane is. Like, and when you look at with the offensive line that the Lions are creating, this is an offensive line that has the potential to create holes. And if they create holes, this is a guy that can hit them and produce. He doesn't often get tackled in the backfield because he's very quick in his decision-making and he can see what's there. So he sees the hole, he hits the hole, and then he goes, right? He in the NFL, he's not going to be a big play guy. In college, he's one of these guys that when he got through the line of scrimmage and he got into the secondary and he got matched up against somebody who tried to take him on, he would bulldoze them over and then he would just run it to the house. He's not going to be able to bulldoze people over in the NFL, but his physical play when he's out in the open is very impressive. And it's enough to kind of make people go, okay, like you got a guy who can see it, hit it, get upfield, and then hit people when he's upfield. That's not bad for a rotational back. And with a couple injury question marks in the Lions backfield, wouldn't surprise me at all if he makes the roster as RB4 and then a guy who ends up getting some playing time somewhere during the season and he ends up producing because you know, he has that style that's really no nonsense. You know, it's see it, hit it, go. And he can produce like that. So, I mean, at the same time, I can also see him getting outproduced by somebody else and not making the roster too. So it's kind of up in the air, but the opportunity is there for him to make the roster.
All right. Sticking with the running backs, let's move into the undrafted free agents. So Jefferson taking three picks from the end of the draft, Rakeem Boyd from Arkansas and Dedrick Mills from Nebraska. Now I'm looking at your big board here, Eric. I don't have you don't have Dedrick Mills on it.
I don't. I had Boyd.
You had Rakeem Boyd for sure.
Yeah. He was a late seventh. No, he was actually undrafted. Sorry.
He was undrafted.
Yeah, that was an undrafted. That was an undrafted grade for me. So he had 20 starts at Arkansas. And I'm sorry, going into the 2020 season, he had 20 starts. He averaged over 6 yards a carry, and that was over 300 touches over those couple of years. But then when he got into 2020, he had just big problems. He had injuries. He tried playing through the injuries for six games. It didn't work. His production dropped off a cliff. He ended up opting out halfway through the season, and it was it really left a bad taste in evaluators' mouths. But if you look back to what he did in 2018, 2019, he was a productive running back. Now, he is similar to Jefferson in that he's an instinctive runner who just sees what's in front of him and then he takes it. He is not fast, just like Jefferson's not fast, but he's quicker than Jefferson. Where Jefferson is more power, Boyd is this kind of like, quick guy. He's more Theo Riddicky, right? He can get skinny in the hole. He's good on screens, which helps him be more, he can contribute on third down. So I don't necessarily think he's better than Jefferson. You know, they weren't close on my board, but you know, you get guys in camp and things happen and guys produce. This is another not very impressive athletically guy who was impressive for a couple of years at Arkansas, but really coming off a tough 2020. Mills, though. All right, sorry. Mills, he's in the same boat, right? He's look, all three of these guys need blown zone blocking schemes. All of them like to get upfield quickly. They take what's in front of them, and he has a little bit of, he has some third down chops as well, but he's not as quick. He has a little bit more power. So he's Mills is more Jefferson than Boyd, but all three of them are the same thing, right? The fourth back on this roster is going to be a no nonsense, see it, hit it, and go type of running back. That's what all three of them are. So it'd be an interesting battle for that four spot.
All right. Now the wide receiver group, Jonathan Adams Jr. sticking in the state of Arkansas, coming from Arkansas State, Javon McKinley from Notre Dame, and Sage Surratt from Wake Forest.
So Adams was Sun Belt Offensive Player of the Year. He had over 1,000 yards receiving, 12 touchdowns last season. He was a guy who kind of put everything together in his senior year. Nothing super stands out athletically. He has good explosion. He has good height speed ratio. Those are a little bit above average for him, but you know, the speed's nothing to write home about. I do like the explosion. Where he's best though is he wins the 50-50 ball, right? This is a guy who, because he doesn't have that quick footedness, he's not a guy who's necessarily going to go like over the middle, but because he can win the 50-50 ball, he's probably going to be a guy that you send deep. But because he doesn't have the long speed to go deep, he's going to be more of a situational guy, which means this is a guy you bring on the field, like in the red zone or, when you want to take a shot or something. So he's not going to be a guy that separates is I guess what I'm getting at here. And because of that, it's going to limit his ability to be successful with Goff. But when you win the 50-50 ball more often than not, well, there's a chance for you to stick in the NFL, right? And so that's really what he brings to the table. If they kept six wide receivers, his name could be in the mix. McKinley, the kid from Notre Dame, highly recruited in high school. He was actually, I believe, ranked over the kid who went last year, and Chase Claiborne. He was ranked ahead of Claiborne in high school. Went to Notre Dame and was expected to be the guy ahead of Claiborne. He was supposed to be the contributor. But he was injured, and then he was injured, and then he missed his sophomore season and had the red shirt because of an injury. Then he was injured as a redshirt sophomore, and then he was injured as a redshirt junior. Then he was arrested as a redshirt junior. And so, like, you never saw him for the first 4 years. In my write-up on these guys, which will drop Tuesday morning, my first line is he's a what-could-have-been type of player because he had all this potential, but it never really came to fruition. Now, he finally started this last year at Notre Dame, and when he was on the field, he looked like an NFL professional. But, you know, you didn't see it. You didn't see it over the first 4 years. You only kind of saw it this year. Like Adams, he's a big body, contested catches type receiver who has, some potential. I think he's got a little bit more potential over the middle than Adams does necessarily, but he's a guy who's going to have to win it by being a situational contributor. So it's a tougher road for McKinley. But if things start to click, this is a type of guy where you're like, where was he in college? You know, because, you know, he seems to have the chops. You see these stories all the time, and you know, maybe he's one of them. Surratt's the big name, I guess, right? Because his brother was drafted, right, as well by the Vikings. And so Surratt's he's the same height, same build as these guys, but he's more of a slot. He's like a big slot. His skill set is more of a guy who's going to live over the middle. Now, he's also good at making contested catches, but he's not the go up and get the 50-50 ball type of contested catch guy. He's more of a, I can work my way through traffic, still make the catch in traffic, even when I know I'm going to get hit. So his biggest obstacle is going to be, it's the same thing Quintez Cephas does, right? Can he outplay Quintez Cephas? You know, he has a good knack for, you know, getting the ball in his hands. Like I said, he can work the middle, but how much more can he do than that? You know, people that were asking, where does Quintez Cephas fit? Well, they're going to be asking the same thing about Surratt. Where does he fit? I think the fact that they got him speaks to the fact that they're looking for that type of role player, right? Which is why I think Cephas, again, is going to have an edge to kind of stick. But I don't know if he can beat Cephas out for that role. And I mean, maybe he can. Maybe he'll impress. But, you know, he was – all three of these guys led their team in receptions. And, you know, for an NFL player, that's not surprising, right? But can he take it to that next level? All three of these receivers have that question. Can they do a little bit more? And I guess all these – offensive undrafted guys, you can say that about. Can they just take their game up a little bit more to overcome why they weren't drafted in the first place?
All right, moving to tight end. Lions stuck going to the Notre Dame well with not Tommy Tremble, but Brock Wright and then Jake Hausman from Ohio State.
So Brock Wright is a very athletic tight end, but he really has never put that athleticism on display. He's always been kind of a blocker. Hausman, it's kind of the same thing. He's not athletic. He's a blocker first, right? So both of these guys are blocker first, and there's a role for that in the NFL. Like, you can be a super athletic guy or an unathletic guy, but if you can block, there's a role for you, right? I can't imagine, from what I know about these guys, of either of them ever being more than a tight end three, but
or guys that Dan Campbell really likes in camp,
right? And you can't rule any tight end out, especially ones that Campbell identifies and, you know, brings on, right? So in a lot of ways, Wright is kind of like a Dan Campbell. He's probably more athletic than Dan was. And, but he's got, you know, both these guys are good blockers, and there's a role for that. You know, we've all been kind of eyeballing Hunter Bryant as that tight end three, but Hunter Bryant, you know, he's on IR now, and it looks like he's going to be on IR for a while. And now what do you do? What type of tight end three are you looking for? Do you need Alize Mack, another Notre Dame tight end? Is he going to step up and be it? Or could one of these guys? I think the door is wide open for Mack, Thedford, Wright, or Hausman. Any of them could end up being tight end three this year. And being a good blocker is going to help out a ton.
All right, moving on to the offensive line. Once again, from Notre Dame, Tommy Kramer is a guard. And center Drake Jackson from Kentucky, former teammate of Logan Stenberg.
Right. So Kramer played, 4 years for Notre Dame, started them all.
He was always out there. Yeah. Always in starting lineup.
And he played one of those years at right tackle and the other ones at right guard. He's a guard in the NFL. I don't think he has the base to hang with those elite athletes on the edge. When he struggles, he bends at the waist. And when he bends at the waist, as we know, you know, when you bend at the waist as an offensive lineman, you're off balance, and then he gets, you know, throttled. So he's not going to be a tackle. He's going to be a guard. But to his benefit, he's very comfortable working inside. He works well in small spaces, and he can be, he was impactful at Notre Dame. Now, with the Lions roster as it was, he might be the second best right guard on the roster. I know, because Stenberg has always been kind of a left guard, and maybe Stenberg can play right guard and kind of knock him off. But right now, Tommy Kramer is your backup right guard. I mean, maybe you could argue there's some other guys like a Matt Nelson or a Crosby who would probably kick in there first ahead of him. But if you're just looking like positionally on the depth chart, from a depth chart perspective, he's going to slot in there. So they like him enough. It wouldn't surprise me if they added a guard in free agency. You know, we talked about those five spots that are open. Wouldn't surprise me if they added one in there. But, you know, Kramer's a guy with some potential. And so we'll see how he plays in camp, how he holds up. You know, there's a lot of people that like him quite a bit. Now, the guy that I like better than him is Drake Jackson. Now, Drake Jackson looks like a center because he's undersized. He is, let me see.
Not even 6'2".
Yeah.
Not even 300 pounds.
Right. But he is stout. I mean, stout. Like Kramer, he started for 4 years on an offensive line that likes to maul you. And, you know, we talked a long time about how Stenberg was a mauler. Well, that was a Kentucky mindset. This guy is the same thing. He 45 starts at center. That's a ton, right? And so he is a guy who's going to, you know, anchor really well. And like we've talked about with a lot of prospects, his hand usage is phenomenal. He has great punch, active hands, good anchor. He's low, so he understands leverage. Maybe he's nothing more than a center. Maybe he's never able to do anything else but that. But there's a role for that. You know, a backup center is a vital player to have on your roster. Now, Jonah Jackson can still do it. Frank Ragnow is obviously there. You have Evan Brown, who's a hybrid center guard. But Jackson is a guy who I think people are really going to like. He's going to look a little bit like an underdog. He's not going to be as big, but he's stout, and he's going to be able to hold his ground. And if fans are allowed to go to training camp this year, I think people will fall in love with him. In my write-up for the superlatives that we did today, I said, you can forget about Bo Benchel. This is your new undrafted free agent offensive line crush. This is the guy that I think people are going to fall in love with. So I think he's going to make the roster. Maybe I shouldn't say make the roster. He's going to be on this roster either on the practice squad, or as one of the like reserve, like offensive linemen. I think he's a guy who's going to play a neat role. Now I'm saying this based on what I've seen on film, right? If I show up at camp and I don't like him, don't hate me for it. Okay. But I like this kid on film. Okay. And I think there's enough there that I'm excited to see what he can bring.
All right. Flipping over to the defensive side of the ball, a lot more. There was 9 undrafted free agents on offense, only 4 on defense.
Yeah.
Linebacker Tavante Beckett from Marshall.
Okay. So he's very undersized, 5'10", 220 pounds. So that is not a guy who is going to live at linebacker in the NFL, but he kind of fits that hang defender role that we've talked about this offseason, where we're looking for a guy who kind of looks like a safety but plays like a linebacker. Well, this is the guy. I don't think you're necessarily going to see him like switch to like a safety spot like some people have projected, but he's very similar. I think his role can be very similar to like what we've seen from Miles Killebrew the last couple of years, a guy who isn't quite going to fit into either safety or linebacker style, body wise, but he's a guy who's going to contribute on special teams. He has good intensity. It shows up on the field when you watch him play. He's comfortable in traffic, and all of those things like make him a good projectable special team contributor. So he could be a guy that I like, if they keep like five linebackers, I could see him being five and then being a guy who like is just, he plays on all the special teams plays, all the special teams downs, because he's you know, he's got that mentality and skill set to fit that role. I don't know. I don't necessarily think if he made the roster, he would be a guy who contributes on defense. But you know, you never know. This is a, with a new staff, you never know how they decide to use players.
All right. Next up is defensive back D'Angelo Amos from Virginia.
Amos is a safety, right? He is a guy who, what am I looking for? He's comfortable in like free safety is kind of where I'm projecting him. He's a unique guy where he played at two different schools, right? He played at Virginia was where he played last year. Before that though, he played at James Madison. James Madison elected to not play this season, and because of that, he transferred to Virginia so he could play this season and get some film. So he was a different player at James Madison than he was at Virginia. But I think he has some range. He's good at like seeing the field and like tracking the ball, right? And that's kind of a mentality that you want in that single high. CJ Moore can do the same thing, right? And so I think he can, he has that, that skill set, right? Additionally, he's a good punt returner. He had five punt returns for touchdowns at James Madison. So he's a guy who's shown he can contribute as a returner. He's shown that he can contribute like as a gunner. And he's got some single high experience as well. So it's a bit of a flyer on him, especially coming from a small school and then not really acclimating that quickly to Virginia. But there's some talent there where you could kind of see him work his way onto the roster. And if he ends up winning a returner job, well then, you know, all the better.
All right. Two more corners, Jerry Jacobs from Arkansas and AJ Parker from Kansas State.
So Jerry Jacobs is aggressive. He's very physical in run support, but he's had some injuries and it's hurt his experience, and that lack of experience has hurt to his development. Because of that, he's a project, right? I think that he could play in the slot. I think he can play on the outside. I would probably try and put him in the slot if I could. But it's going to take him some time before he's able to contribute. He had an ACL in 2019 that cost him time. He ended up playing a few games this season and then opting out. So I don't know. He's only played like, I think, seven games in the last 2 years. So it's a work in progress, right? You talked earlier about the guys opting out having some concern. Well, this is the same thing, right? He's not only did he opt out, but he also was injured the year prior. And so you're really kind of projecting what he can do. Maybe he can come out and surprise. He seems like a developed type guy. Now, Parker, he did start pretty much the last 3.5-4 years at Kansas State. He lined up outside, but most of the time it was in the nickel. I mean, like, he's lined up at all the different spots at Kansas State, but in the NFL, I think he's going to stay at the nickel. He's kind of the opposite, where he is a smooth athlete. He's good in coverage. He's not as good at run support, so he's a little bit different than Jacobs in that aspect. He can play off. We talked about that with Melifonu, how he can play in that off coverage. He has good tracking skills. He gets his hands on the ball quite a bit. I think he has 6 interceptions in his career. He could be a potential dime back. Like, he could be your backup nickelback. And he can also be like a gunner. He could also challenge to be a gunner as well. So I think he has a little bit more potential to stick because he's more ready to go, I think, than Jacobs is.
All right, and that's it. Now, one thing, you know, we're pretty good on time here. A lot was addressed, but there's a big hole still when you look at your depth chart. I mean, there's several holes, but the biggest one is starting safety. We're still missing a starting safety. They did not come away from this draft with one.
Yeah, I think of all the surprises, that was the biggest one. Right. Drafting back-to-back defensive tackles was a surprise to me, of course, but not coming away with the safety, man, that was mildly concerning. But again, you're drafting for value and you're drafting guys that you're putting in place that are not drafting for need. So how do you fill that need? Well, you got 5 spots on the roster, and that means you're probably going back to free agency, right?
Right.
Trey Boston is still a free agent. He has experience with Anthony Lynn. His best season as a pro was with Anthony Lynn and the Chargers. He would slot right into that role. I think Trey Boston would be a guy that they could go after. Malik Hooker is going to be a guy that everyone loves because he was a flashy free safety at Ohio State, and there's tons of potential when he's healthy, but he's not always healthy. Those two guys stand out to me. As of right now, the Lions can go sign any player they want, and it doesn't count against the comp formula. The whole comp formula thing is set. There's no impacting that with anything anymore. So if you want to go sign Trey Boston to $6 million, and it's not going to impact that comp formula, you can do it, right? But I think they might. I think they are. It's a good chance they could go after and try and sign some sort of safety to compete with Will Harris. There's also some nickelbacks that are out there that maybe might be interesting. Desmond King, Brian Poole, Nicole Roby-Coleman, who we've talked about previously, who's had success with Aubrey Pleasant in the past. I could see them try and upgrade Cornelder with a nickel guy as well. And then when you look at the roster overall, you only have 12 offensive linemen, and you typically go into camp with 15. So you could use 3 offensive linemen. So could they sign 3 offensive linemen, a starting nickel and a starting safety? Absolutely. They have the cap room for it. They could make it work. And I don't know. I don't think anyone would be unhappy with either with them adding 2 defensive backs and a couple of veteran offensive linemen. Because right now, outside of the starters, it's Tyrell Crosby and Matt Nelson. And then Evan Brown is only in his couple years in the league. Logan Stenberg hasn't played a snap yet. And then, like I said before, Tommy Kramer. So you could go get an offensive lineman. I think Trey Turner might still be out there but I don't think, I don't know what kind of money he's going to want. I don't have an updated list in front of me, so I don't know off the top of my head. But I know there's guys out there.
Something we can talk about next week.
Yeah. But I could see them going and trying to get a backup tackle, a backup guard, at least one, maybe 2. And then, a couple other guys and try and fill those holes in with those last couple of spots. And you also have some spots where you could shed people if you needed to. Right now you have 12 receivers. That's fine. But you have 6 tight ends. That's fine. 6 running backs, 3 quarterbacks, 2 fullbacks. You have 2 kickers. You could lose one of those guys if you wanted. I doubt you do. But you got 8 linebackers, you got 5 edge rushers, you got 11 defensive linemen for 3 spots, you're probably losing one of those guys. You have eight safeties, and if you're going to sign one, you could lose one. So there's some spots where they could shed a contract or two and bring in a contract or two, and they got a little bit of room and a little bit of money, and this is where you fill those last few needs that you have.
Yeah, so that's it. Let's I guess we're going to go through and cover that a little bit more in depth next time around. That's all we got, and that was a lot.
Yeah, I feel like I talked for most of it, but
we have to let you get it all out. This is your time of the year. You might explode if you keep it all in. That's why we had it. There came a point where it's like, I better just let him go. Better let him unwind.
I appreciate it. Overall, I think, I don't know, there's a couple of things that made sense, a couple of things that surprised me. Overall, though, if I'm going to put one word on this draft, I feel like they got value. They got value pretty much everywhere. I don't know if there's anything that stands out. You don't necessarily have to put one word on it. But overall, like, do you have an impression of this draft that you – like a strong impression that you, that like kind of sits with you? Or I know I'm putting you on the spot, but what do you
– they're obviously focused, you know, on the lines, you know, and building through the trenches, which kind of goes in contrast to what Spielman was saying a few months ago. But then again, Spielman's not the general manager, and he's mm-hmm. not making these decisions. You can see there is a commitment to building up front, and I understand they may have made these decisions more based on value than the fact that this is what they were going to do, you know, but mm-hmm. they still decided to do it. So there is a commitment to beefing up those lines, which I think is a good thing. It could turn out poorly because, you know, hey, that happens, you know, for most franchises, you know, and we're just a little bit worse at it than most of the other ones, but you know, I don't mind the strategy they went after.
What's interesting is that when you start reflecting back on to things that we heard from this front office, build from the outside in. Well, they didn't do that. Holmes in his second press conference talked about this being a deep safety class, and then he doesn't take any of them. It's very interesting. So
you think those are red flags? Those are possibly red flags, like all the saying one thing, doing another. But then you got to do what falls to you, how the chips fall to you, right?
Right.
You
know? Well, I'm also wondering if those are like seeds.
Smoke screens.
Yeah. I mean, could they have been planting seeds already? I don't think they were. I think they would have liked to have gotten a safety. I think they would have liked to have built a little bit stronger on the outside. I don't think they were smoke screens, but it's interesting. Like, can I ask one more thing?
Sure.
Brett Holmes has been extraordinarily open about things and talking about how, Sewell was one of three guys that they would have been willing to take at seven. And it's very interesting, this approach. He hasn't really kept things as much to the vest. Do you like that approach, or do you like the I want to keep all my secrets in house so that nobody knows what we're doing?
No. The Holmes approach is fine. I'd rather it's been a problem with the Lions that they would never come out and talk about what they're doing. You know, there was a lot of communication with the fans. Now we're getting some of that. And I get Belichick, and that's what he does. And he's won more Super Bowls than anyone, you know, as a coach. So I get it. And Matt Patricia and Bob Quinn didn't do anything in their lives to like deserve that level of, you know, to do the same thing. They could do whatever they want, right? They were the GM and coach, but I always thought it was nonsense. Like, this is football. These 32 teams are filled with employees that like get football and get why teams are doing certain things. Like, you don't have to be that secretive about it. Like, it's fine with the fans and maybe it's fun, but like all these other people in the business, they get it. They can see what you're doing and get it. You don't have to be so closed about it.
I think the other thing that kind of resonated with me was that there were very logical decisions on why they made the picks that they made. And I don't think we often had that last year, you know, with last couple of drafts anyways.
Oh no. Yeah. Nope.
Right. It was, they picked Tavai and like, I could see why they picked him for what they were trying to accomplish, and that made sense. But in the grand scheme of things, it didn't make sense.
Trading, they didn't use him as that, and they could have drafted him in the fifth round.
Trading up for Will Harris didn't make sense to me. And I think they traded up for him because when they did that, it was because they had what's his name as defensive coordinator, the former Boston College coach. Oh my gosh,
Pasqualoni.
Pasqualoni, right? Yeah, Pasqualoni was his defensive coordinator, right? And so I honestly think that like GMs are guilty of that, of saying, well, this was your coordinator, we have your coach is now on our staff, so we're going to go get this player because of that coach. But then again, it could just be there's connections, you know, that's just how it goes. Like, for example,
they trust whoever's talking about it. Yeah, right. I get that.
I mean, like, for example, Hank Fraley was the UCLA offensive line coach when Penei Sewell was going from high school to college, and he recruited Sewell. Now, do I think that they drafted Sewell because Hank Fraley attended a high school game that Sewell played in? No, right? I think those are the coincidences that just happened. But trading up for Will Harris because his defensive coordinator is now your defensive coordinator, that seemed like black and white to me. Like, that's why they did that, right? Yeah. I don't see that as much here. I don't know. I like what they came away with. It's probably not the route I would have gone at a couple of spots, but I understand it. And they're walking away with, like we said, six players that a year from now could all be in starting roles. And if that ends up happening in sometime in the next 2 years, let's say, if all six of these guys sometimes in the next 2 years are starting, well, then they will have succeeded in this draft.
Oh, sure. Like, yeah, if five of these six guys, like, that would be incredible because, you know, yeah, the hit rate isn't that great. Like, if five of these guys are really good and big-time contributors, well, then it was a great draft.
Right.
Even better. I mean, I hope Sewell's a multiple-time Pro Bowler, if not an All-Pro.
Right.
Like, that seems to be, like, that's the expectation that's kind of being laid in front of him. So he probably has to live up to that. And then the rest of these guys, as long as they're effective players, you know, yeah, they would have had a very solid draft, but we're only going to know that it's going to take a few years.
Yeah. It's going to take a couple. Yeah. We're a couple of years away from knowing how good this is or not, and how good these guys are or not. So, all right. I feel like I'm starting to talk about stuff we can talk about next time too. So
yeah, yep.
I'll put a pin in this. I will note that we have more reviews. We're up to 372 on our ratings on iTunes.
Yeah. It's awesome.
A couple more written reviews. One of them, Aaron from Lansing, who points out that I take a breath before I speak all the time, which I've noticed myself. I don't do it on purpose. My mic is the mic we have is really good. It yep. picks everything up, and when I take a breath before I talk, it sounds like it definitely gets picked up. And then the other one is from Michaels 711. Two very nice reviews for us. We appreciate that. I'm helping people educate people about football, like Michaels is saying here. And so I'm excited that we're still getting reviews. I'm excited that we can put this behind us and start talking about what's next, right? Because now the fun stuff happens. Now we really start to break down these guys, and we start to break down the rest of the roster, and we start to see, you know, what's the future look like. That it's going to be fun.
Yeah, especially with the new regime. Like, it's not going to be same old, same old. We don't even know what's coming. So that's good. Hey, it's great. Everybody's still listening. We really appreciate it. And that's all we got this week. And we'll see you next time. And until that time, let's go Lions. Ooh.